When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early! Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
John Britton, the man and his revolutionary motorcycles. John Britton has taken his place as a New Zealand hero since his tragically early death from cancer in 1995. To tell us more about the man, the motorcycles and the legend is Tim Hannah. Tim, good morning to you.
Good morning to you too. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Whereabouts are you, by the way? You sound like you're not just around the corner. You're over in New Zealand.
Yeah, we're just about up from the South Pole, bottom of the South Island.
Wonderful. Right, for those who don't know much about, well, tell us a little bit about yourself, Tim. Why are you the man to write about John?
Well, I'm a writer, so that was the beginning.
Right.
I'm a motorcyclist of long standing. I had the same Norton Commando for decades, and I had it when I met John. And I met John to write a magazine article about him. And we got on. We just hit it off. And he liked the article when it came out. It wasn't a puff piece, but he appreciated that it was honest. And he and I then saw each other mostly at racetracks when the Britain team would be racing. If I was around, I'd go and hang out. And I always had a really good time with him, like everybody did. I mean, that was the thing about John. Where John was, that was where the party was.
So tell us a little bit about then, the motorcycle racing scene in New Zealand, and obviously John's role within it, and then the development of the motorcycles themselves.
Well, the motorcycle scene here is pretty much like it is, I guess, anywhere. We tend to have a Formula 2 race, which is a production motorcycle race, as our premier competition. So when I first met John, it was all about GSX 1100 Suzuki's, John liked old things. He was a classicist in many senses. He loved Art Deco. He designed Art Deco buildings. He loved old cars. Had an old Triumph Gloria and a beautiful old Stuart truck. He liked motorcycles that were not, top of the line. He raced a Triumph 500. And he raced it very, very hard. It was the one after the Springer. It was a Tiger, I think. And he was He was a really inveterate motorcyclist. He from the moment he got on a bike, he just loved racing and he liked riding. He fell off a lot, buried himself in various banks around Canterbury, and it was said that when he was racing the Triumph, it was terrifying to be on track with him, because when he went past you, he'd either tap you on the shoulder or give you a little pat on the back, as he went through, you could see the front wheel would be going one end one way, the back wheel would be going the other. It was shot. He was never a guy who spent an enormous amount of time refining his own stuff. And the Triumph was, it had virtually no brakes. He put the two drums on the front, as people did in those days, but it really didn't work very well. And then he got his first Ducati, and I think it was new, and he really sort of realised that motorcycles, he began to appreciate better motorcycles, and he did a little bit of racing at a much higher level than just the sort of club stuff. I mean, they used to turn up at the track in Christchurch at Ruapuna.
Yeah.
When a group called the Country Gentlemen would have races for their old cars, and they'd try and scrounge a race for their pom-poms, as they called them. In the end, they were told to bugger off. So they formed their own club, which was called Bears, British European American Racing.
Oh, love it. I absolutely love that.
British European American Racing.
Love
they
it.
They could have just called it No Jappers. Because that's essentially what it was. They knew that racing anywhere where there were Japanese motorcycles was a waste of time. So they made their own. And then out of that experience, John began to get ideas about building a bike. He was a true fantasist. He imagined a lot of things. And I mean, the first time I met him, we spoke mostly over lunch about his ideas about flapping wing aircraft.
Right.
That was something that he was exploring at the time. But he persisted with this plan, and they used initially the Speedway motor that was manufactured in Christchurch for their first couple of bikes, and that motor made an enormous amount of torque and wouldn't rev. It was a horrible thing. I'm being unkind, but it was hard, and it spat a lot of tears. It spat Alan Cashcart off at one point, because it would go off on one cylinder and come on another, and then it would chime in and spit everybody off. It was a dangerous bike. But he sent that off to America, off to Jerry Branch at Flowmetrics in California. And Jerry at that time was developing the new Harley race engine, which eventually became the V-Rod.
Mm-hmm.
So Jerry took one look at this thing and sent it back with the suggestion that he could take up boating and use it as an anchor.
love it.
And he said, but he also sent a profile drawing of the head that he was working on with the flow figures for it. And this was the Harley motor. And that gave John all he needed. So from then on, the whole project really kicked up a notch. And they ended up making their own casings and their own cranks and rods. Well, they bought the rods, but they built their own engine. They put a GSX gearbox in it, and they initially put it into a carbon fiber shell. And it was, somebody said it was like sitting on an apple box with a motor going in it.
The Britain V1000, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, What is it? World flying mile record, yeah? 302 yeah. kilometres an hour, mate. I mean, that's not hanging around, is it?
No, I mean, the thing is, they'd actually built a streamlined version of it with a guzzy kind of streamlined body on it that somebody was putting on a guzzy. And they used that, and then they found that that didn't work out. So it was actually pretty much a stripped-down bike that did it. It wasn't enhanced. And the thing about John's idea of streamlining was that, you know, knees are pointy, so let's just have them out in the air. Why bother carrying them? His biggest, I think, contribution in some ways to streamlining was to locate the radiator under the seat of the bike.
Yeah.
And then run the air for the radiator from the front of the fairing, a bikini fairing, through the tank and then out the back. And that worked really well. So he didn't see any point in fairing, you know, the bottom of the bike, and hence the expression that he used, which was a bullet on a knife edge.
Yep.
And he went from having a monocoque body with the mechanics sort of bolted to the body to basically building everything off the engine. So the front end came off the front head, the back end came off the back of the gearbox, which was, of course, attached to the motor. Everything else was held on a sort of a framework of carbon fiber that weighed, I think, about 4 kilos. And that held the tank and the seat and the radiator. So there was no frame at all, nothing. And then the front end, of course, was a girder-type front end.
Yeah.
And it was very light, and it made good power. So, you know, it was a bike. You could open it up at 150 and lift the wheel.
But the other thing, you know, and I'm not going to get all sort of like, you know, designer, you know, put me designer glasses on, but the great thing about, you know, the Bauhaus said form follows functions, and there's something very attractive about the way it looks. I mean, so much that, didn't the Guggenheim put it on, you know, put it on display as part of their Art of the Motorcycle exhibition?
Yeah, well, the great thing, I love that story, because the Guggenheim is a spiral, right? Yeah. It spirals up. It's all one floor. And you gradually go up and around. And I think maybe Curtis's V8 was down the bottom, you know, the one that he set land speed record on in, what, 1996 or whenever it was. And at the very, very top was the Britain. And I think, you know, there can't be a finer appraisal of anything than to go out with absolutely unlimited funds and select the motorcycles that you would consider to be the most important in the world, and then to put the Britain at the very top.
I mean, what was the sort of trepidation when it first made its appearance on the track? Did people think, and where did it make its first appearance as a racer? And you know, you said, you know, there were, I mean, there's an awful lot of like little Jap rockets, you know, and, you know, Ducatis thundering around. Did people think, okay, because I mean, this wasn't done on the budget of a mega corporation, was it? This was literally sort of, you know, blood, sweat, and bleeding tears, mate.
Yeah, John had a great ability to attract other people to his project.
Yeah,
and so he did have some really top guys, and he, you know, there were a lot of things that took a long time to refine. Like the EMS was terrible; it was always breaking down, and it robbed them of race wins for about 2 years. And I think it was finally sorted when a instruments technician from Air New Zealand came on board and properly housed it and isolated it from vibration. And, you know, but it took 2 years to do that, do you know what I mean? When they first took the bike out of Daytona, which was kind of its first international sort of appearance.
Daytona. So no pressure, yeah. No pressure then, just a small race meet.
Well, there was a race series at the time called Pro Twins, right? And there were Japanese bikes in Pro Twins, but they didn't really have anything of... I'm not trying, you know.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything there that was particularly effective. It was mostly European stuff and very hot privateer teams with decent money and a lot of effort and producing some really good stuff. But the Britain had a, you know, had 150 horsepower, so, and it weighed bugger all, and it was just absolutely in a, you know, it was a purpose-built weapon.
Yeah.
And it was in a class of its own. But the funny thing was, it was wheels damaging through the infield. And I think it was Andrew Straub was riding it.
Yeah.
And there was some fast bike for Archie Ducatis there. And this thing was eating them. And it would just take them at will. And it would often do it on the back wheel. Well, what was actually happening was that the pivot point for the rear end was too high. And when you opened the throttle, it snatched the chain, which pulled the front wheel up. It was actually very hard to keep the wheel on the ground.
So you're basically riding a 1,000cc unicycle most of the time, then, mate.
Yeah. That's exactly right. And it took a while to refine it.
Yeah.
But they persisted, you know. And I think I read that back at that time, it cost something like, was millions and millions of dollars to win a 250 GP championship. I mean, millions, many, many, but I think it was Kojima. So for this guy to do what he did and to be right up there, because at the end of the day, it was racing back in Pro Twins. It was racing some really fast factory stuff. And the very last really big race it had was at Oschersleben in Germany.
Yeah.
And the rider took off and he went. He did three quarters of a lap. Then he stole a look over his shoulder to see where everyone was. And there was no one in sight. So he thought, well, the race has been called off. So
genius.
He slowed right down. And then he finally saw a couple of things in the distance. And went, oh, it's still there. So he wound it up. But, you know, I think there's a couple of things. It was a long time ago that I wrote the book.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's now been revived and it's been re-edited and all the rest of it. But I've been thinking about it, and I think what you said was true. It's very beautiful, and I think it's very beautiful in a very traditional way. Mm. Even though it's as radical as it is, it reminds me of something that Paul Dunstall might have done, you know, had he continued to do things. It's got that sort of Norton-y, Dunstall-y look to it, to me anyway. And, of course, it's a V-twin. We all love V-twins.
Yeah.
And it just made huge horsepower. It was just the winning machine.
Now, only 10 of them were built, weren't they? Because it's handcrafted. So, I mean, it was never going to... I'm just really struck because, I mean, and here comes the last statement for the bleeding obvious, but New Zealand is a very, very long way away, you know, to most races, to Europe, to even to the US racing. So it just goes to show that, you know, I'm a four-wheel guy, so I'm thinking Denny Holm, I'm thinking McLaren, you know, I'm thinking all the great drivers come out of there and, you know, go to England. But you've got to have a commitment to go racing in Europe and go racing in the States. And it must have been, you know, he must have really taken people, it just goes to show the charisma of the guy, as well as being brilliant in terms of designing it, to actually get people on board, yeah?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And I think also, as soon as people saw it, they loved it.
Yeah.
So he got people on board within his own team, but then it got the greater motorcycling public. I mean, my brother lived in Ireland for many years, and he told me the story about being in a pub in Dublin, unusual circumstance, I know.
Exactly, but yeah.
There were two young guys who were having a pint, and one of them said, if you could have anything, what would it be? And the other one said, well, it'd be a Ducati. And then he stopped himself and said, no, wait a minute, it'd be one of those effing Britain. This is a young guy years later in Dublin. And I mean, the amount of excitement that it caused in motorcycle circles was way way above and beyond, you know, its actual, you know, the things that it actually achieved. But what it achieved was enough to say that it was all real. You know, it did perform. It did the things that it was supposed to do.
Yeah.
It lived up to the legend. So, you know, it's a beautiful story. And, I mean, there were no drawings for that bike. I think they started doing the drawings at the very end. But every bike was retro-engineered from the last one.
Yeah.
So, you know, to build 10 bikes that way, which is what they built in terms of that, you know, of that particular, the V1000. That's a very long. I was there for the building of the final bike, and it took 2 years.
I'm gonna run out of time. I just wanted to talk about a couple of things here before we run out of time, mate.
Sure.
Because it's all going wonderfully. He's married to a model. I mean, a filmer, Miss Canterbury. He's got a beautiful family. He wins the Sir Richard Hadley Award in 1994. All is going great, and then he gets taken by the proverbial. You know, he gets taken by. I was going to swear then by cancer. Literally, like a year later. I mean, obviously, devastating loss because there was so much more he still had to offer, and ridiculously young.
Yeah, and it was devastating. I mean, when I was, I remember very well where I was when there was this TV thing, an announcement sort of, was the news, and they just won a race. I think they'd won in Holland, and there was a film of him in bed, looking skeletal and real, and pumping his arms up and down as he always did, and wildly excited because they'd won again, because he loved winning, he really did.
Yeah,
and I think there were about four of us in the room, and we were all utterly overwhelmed. You know, motorcyclists can be pretty harsh.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, especially in the racing world, you almost. You expect death. It's a reality. It's there. It's happening.
Yeah.
But that was particularly difficult, and I recall it. I think a lot of people had that reaction.
I mean, at the funeral. I mean, the funeral procession. There's, I mean, thousands of people there turn out. There's the bikes at the front of the procession, which is really, really touching. And then I just this got me. This really got me about. I'm just going to read from what I've got here. It said. Andrew Strood had written the Britain V1000 past the checkered flag many times, read from ICA and 1 Corinthians. And Mayor Vicky Buck, who presented John with a special civic award just 2 weeks before, concluded her heartfelt eulogy with the thought that when John arrived at the pearly gates, he would suggest to St. Peter that he redesigned them.
Exactly. That was true. I'll be very quick.
But yeah.
He decided in one of it, because he was a developer, he took over his father's development company, and they were putting tram lines for vintage trams into Christchurch, to the sort of a tourist thing. Of course, John said, no, this should be our new public transport system. We should, you know, evolve this and make it bigger. And he had his own development, and he redesigned the whole thing without telling them so that it ran into his development. And he made one of the major stops on the whole thing. And with an hour to go before they signed off on the whole project, he walked into the council and persuaded them that he could reroute it completely with the existing track that they'd already ordered. And they signed off on it. I mean, that was the sort of thing that he'd do. Because he was a very charming man. He was a lovely guy.
Yeah.
It was a lot, like I said, a lot of fun to be around. So,
he
was very persuasive.
The book is called John Britton, The Man and His Evolutionary Motorcycle. It's by Tim Hannah. Listeners, you can order it. If you go onto the Talk Radio Europe virtual bookstore, you'll see a picture of the bike, and it is a thing of beauty, and also a picture of the man himself. Click on that, and a well-known distribution service will be getting it to you. Not as quick as the Britton V1000, but there you go. Tim, have you got a website? Do you do social media? Can people find you online?
Not really. Sorry, I read I've got another book coming out called Kim, which is a book about Kim Newcombe. It's being re-edited and republished.
Yeah.
Kim Newcombe was a Kiwi who built his own Grand Prix motorcycle and came second in 1973 in the World Championship.
Well,
think about that.
I might just get you back on that one because I used to work with I used to work for a certain Mr. Phil Reed. So therefore, that's about the right time, mate. Yeah.
Yeah, Speedy. Sorry, I call him Speedy. I know Phil pretty well. Phil was the guy who beat him.
Yeah.
And Kim. Ago. And he built this bloody bike. It used a German outboard motor. It was a two-stroke four-cylinder. It's horizontally opposed. He ran a Norton gearbox. He built the whole damn thing. He developed it. He was a scrambled rider, not a road racer, but yep. He came second.
You get the balance if you go scrambling. That's the thing, Tim. Yep. I'm going to cut it short. You have made me laugh. The story about Austria has made me laugh, and I will repeat that on several times. The book is called John Britton, the man is revolutionary motorcycles. It's by Tim Hannah. Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning, mate.
Oh, mate, it's been a pleasure. Good on you.